For me, the gift of your attention a little bit longer, I'd like to reflect a little bit more on this theme of joy in the path. As I mentioned this morning, this quality of joy is most often held within and presented within what are called the four Brahma Viharas of metta, of kindness, of compassion, of joy and equanimity. And in this context, it's often presented as being an altruistic joy, a celebration of the well-being and the happiness of others. But I'd like to speak of joy actually in the much broader ways that joy is spoken of in the path. Certainly within the Brahma Viharas, it occupies a very essential place, but I'm sure any of you who are familiar with this teaching probably knows that the qualities of metta, compassion, and equanimity are spoken about much more frequently than the quality of joy. Yet in reality, they're all interwoven. Longchenpa, one of the great teachers of the past, he once said, "Out of the soil of friendliness grows the bloom of compassion. Watered by the tears of joy, sheltered under the cool shade of the tree of equanimity." It's kind of a portrayal of how these qualities are so interwoven and how important they are in this path. And we would ask why. Because you can see that the whole direction of this path of understanding, this path of awakening, this path of cultivation really begins with our own willingness to find the courage to turn towards our life. And in doing so, we often find that we're being asked to find the courage to turn towards the many layers of pain, of suffering, of adversity that exist in the world and ourselves. Without compassion, without joy, without friendliness, that meeting can actually feel quite overwhelming. Joy is essential, as we're asked in this path, to turn with mindfulness towards our own minds and bodies and lives. And when we do that, we often do find a lot that seems broken or that seems imperfect. And you notice that when there's an absence of metta, or when there's an absence of joy or compassion or equanimity, in that meeting with the difficult, the painful, the imperfect, the mind becomes so easily contracted and identified. And actually, without joy, in that meeting with the difficult can even feel to be magnified. And the sense of self and the self of sense of other and the gap between them even magnified. What is the purpose of joy? It's not kind of Pollyanna thinking that, you know, everything's wonderful, everything's lovely, you know. The purpose of joy is to gladden the heart. The purpose of joy is to bring spaciousness and ease. And like all of the other qualities in the Brahma Viharas, joy is not described as being a state or just a feeling, somehow separate and apart from all other states or feelings, but it's described as a way of being present. A way of being present with sadness, a way of being present with sorrow, a way of being present with loss in the midst of the difficult. So much of this path, and I think this part is often ignored in this practice, about how much of this path we're learning to cultivate something. We're learning to bring something into being. We're nurturing our sense of capacity. and we're cultivating the capacity for joy. In the Dhammapada, the Buddha says, live in joy, in love, even amongst those who hate. Live in joy, in health, even among the afflicted. Live in joy, in peace, even among the troubled. Look within, be still, free from fear and attachment. Know the sweet joy of the way. Now, joy is spoken of in many, many different ways in this teaching. There's a dimension of sensual joy, of rapture, of celebration, of appreciation, of altruistic joy. The Buddha speaks often of the joy of contentment, the joy of gratitude, of generosity, and most deeply, the joy of coming to know an awakened heart and mind. Looking at our own experience, we do see that this mind that we have, this heart that we have, that seems to have so much capacity and potential to experience such depths of torment and struggle and alienation and conflict, it is in reality exactly the same mind and heart that has the capacity and the potential to know profound levels of joy, to know very profound levels of gladness and ease and delight. And much of this path, much of this practice is, in truth, it's an invitation. It's an invitation to stop, to look carefully at our own hearts and minds, to look carefully at our own moment-to-moment experience, and to understand for ourselves what is really going on. To really bring that quality of investigation to see what is actually going on in our own experience. To look and to be very mindful without judgment or without blame at our capacity for contractedness and for struggle, and also to see and to nurture our own capacity for gladness. In this teaching of the Buddha, he doesn't really speak about accidents. He doesn't really say, well, you know, if you're really lucky or somehow you're karmically and blessed, you're likely to stumble into lots of moments of joy. And somehow if you're really unlucky in this life or somehow, you know, something's gone wrong in your own mind, you're going to have a lot of moments of torment. What the Buddha really speaks about, and I think in this path, if you look at it carefully, part of it is learning to take the bewilderment out of our lives. You know, the bewilderment that often comes when we find ourselves lost in some terribly contracted space and say, how did this happen? How did I end up here? Often followed by the word again. It's actually this asking us to look, there are processes. There's a process. It's not an accident. And these processes can be understood. And when we understand the processes, we have choices. We have choices about what we cultivate, about what we feed, and what we bring into being. The path of joy is an insight practice. It's an insight practice. It involves that level of investigation. It involves that level of cultivation. And part of that practice is also seeing for ourselves what it is in our own life that stifles or suffocates or smothers our capacity for joy. And perhaps to also see that we may not actually be the sort of contracted, anxious person we believe ourselves to be. Rumi, he put it in a poem he wrote, he said, your grief for what you've lost lifts a mirror up to where you're bravely working Expecting the worst, you look, and instead, here's the joyful face you've been wanting to see. Your hand opens and closes and opens and closes. If it were always a fist or always stretched open, you will be paralyzed. Your deepest presence is in every small contracting and expanding, the two as beautifully balanced and coordinated as birds' wings. Now, as I mentioned this morning, joy very much grows in the ground of metta. In my own experience, without metta, without kindness, without friendliness, without the willingness to stand beside our experience, there really isn't the ground for joy to grow. But metta, this quality of metta that we cultivate in the practice, is part of it is our capacity to see and to respond actually to the goodness in ourselves and others, no matter how deluded or how confused we or others may seem to be. Part of metta is our capacity to honor in ourselves and in others our very much our shared longing for safety, for peace, for acceptance, for warmth, and again, no matter how confused or deluded those longings may manifest. On an even more essential level, the metta in which joy finds its root has very much this ground level of integrity, of ethics. And any of you who've been exposed to this teaching in the past knows how much emphasis the Buddha puts upon cultivating a ground of integrity and ethics in our lives. And it's not a question of right or wrong or good or bad. It's about taking care of the quality of our minds. In many ways, ethics, as far as I understand it in Buddhist teaching, is a gesture of respect for ourselves. And it's a gesture of respect for others. Because what happens, when the Buddha talked about ethics, he often talks about it as words and acts and thoughts of kindness. Words, acts, and thoughts of kindness. The effect of ethics, of course, in terms of Buddhist psychology, is really to free the mind of residues. It's to free the mind of residues. Remember when I spoke earlier about the mind being so cluttered or so full? One of the ways in which the mind gets so cluttered and full is with residues. The residues, I wish I hadn't said that. I wish I hadn't done that. I wish I had said this that I didn't say. I wish I hadn't acted in this way. The kind of regrets and the self-blaming and the self-condemnation that happens when we somehow feel that we betray our most deeply held values. The sort of shadows of that that linger in the mind. So when the Buddha puts ethics and metta as the root of joy, it's really about freeing the mind from residues. It's about creating more space. It's actually about cultivating that sense of respect and about being at ease with ourselves. Mostly that. About being at ease with ourselves. Not in conflict with ourselves. This is a training. This is even described as the joy of blamelessness. The happiness of blamelessness. Of feeling that happiness inwardly. But is it when the Buddha talks about ethics, he doesn't talk about adopting a set of commandments or a set of rules. Yet he talks about it as an investigation. And in one place in the Dhammapada, the Buddha says, the disciplined heart invites true joy. I find that interesting. We often wouldn't put those words together, of discipline and joy. He says, the disciplined heart invites true joy. And that is a mind that is really inclined, and not only inclined, but that is truly embodying what we most deeply value. And I don't know how that is for you, but for me that is a practice. That is a training. One element of joy that is spoken about is the realm of sensual joy or sensual appreciation. Think of how the world would be without wonderful music or art or literature. Think of how our lives would be if we felt it was somehow a sin to enjoy a sunset or to listen to a bird with delight or to the laugh of a child. Sensual joy is part of our life. Sensual joy is something very, very different than sensual craving. You can see in sensual craving there's almost never enough, is there? I'm trying to satisfy something that feels to be lacking in myself. Sensual joy is simply opening our capacity to be touched by the lovely. And again, this is very important in this path. And as I mentioned, because, you know, there is often this shadow side that we feel it's somehow more virtuous or more noble, you know, to be focusing on just what is difficult, you know. And there's a kind of a spiritual ideology, you know, that the more you suffer, the holier you become. It's not always true. Sometimes the more we suffer, the more miserable we become, and the more prone to suffering we become. So sensual joy is part of the practice as a way of glimpsing our heart's capacity for appreciation, our heart's capacity for wholeheartedness. In reality, it doesn't matter what it is, if it's a great symphony or it's just the ability to delight in a child's laughter. In a way, it doesn't matter what it is, but we know those moments in our life when we have that quality of presence that allows us to be touched by what is sensual joy, a joy of a sound, a sight, a touch. It's a glimpse of the heart's capacity, and it is important, and it's not something to be afraid of for fear that it turns into clinging. Another dimension of joy that is spoken of in the path is often referred to as a quality called piti, or it's a Pali word for rapture. It's a very energetic, often a very energetic felt sense of joy. It's often associated with the very, very blissful states that are born of very deep concentration and absorption, meditative states. Now, again, I mean, this is a reality for numerous people in the path as they practice more concentration, more focus, that they touch upon these kind of altered states of consciousness that are actually permeated by very profound levels of rapture or bliss. Now again, the Buddha was very, very careful in cautioning against pursuing these states as ends in themselves, because they do arise and pass like all other states, dependent on conditions. And yet, if you ever have the interest in reading any Buddhist discourses, any of the discourses of the Buddha, you will not avoid noticing how often also the Buddha stresses the development of some of these deep states of concentration. Why? What is their worthiness if they just arise and they pass and they're just states? Well, their worthiness, in my understanding, these very deep states of concentration joy, is the unshakable glimmer or glimpse that they offer to us of the potential of our own hearts and minds. The potential that our hearts and minds have to know a profound, inwardly generated joy. And that's the key phrase here. Inwardly generated. Not born of getting something, not born of getting rid of anything, but the joy that is really discovered through developing this very deeply collected heart and mind, freed from fragmentation and distortion, freed from obsession, freed from the grip of the hindrance factors, what is glimpsed in these very deep states of concentration, the joy that comes, is a mind of remarkable happiness, a heart of remarkable delight, and basically a mind that is truly a friend. That's really the most significant part, is to really discover this mind that you can rely upon and that you can see as being truly a friend to you in your life. But the other part, I think, of this inwardly, this glimpse of this inwardly generated joy is actually a real taste of inner sufficiency. Because certainly the mind, the heart that really touches upon these places of joy or happiness knows in that moment there is absolutely nothing missing. There is nothing lacking, nothing incomplete. It's that sense of inner completeness, and that changes our relationship to the world. You know, even though the states may arise and pass, the insights that they offer are that they change our relationship to the world, because we can probably see in our life how much time we can spend pursuing things in the world for a quality of happiness that we feel to be absent in ourselves. You know, if I get this, I'll be happy. If I get that, I'll be happy. Feeling that it's a substitute for something we feel to be missing inwardly. And the shift that happens in really touching upon those inwardly generated places of joy and happiness is that the unshakable knowing that there is nothing, absolutely nothing, you're going to get or obtain that can actually offer in any way the quality of happiness that is generated inwardly through that deep level of collectiveness. So actually the inside part of these concentration states is actually to bring a much greater sense of ease and well-being in our relationship to the world around us. A relationship in which actually there's often a much easier sense of giving rather than pursuing. There's a quality, another quality of joy that is spoken of, which is a kind of an appreciative joy. A very heartfelt appreciation of ourselves and others. It's the dimension in this practice in which the quality of gratitude is encouraged as something to truly develop. Find you. Martin Luther King Jr., I think, really expressed this so well. He said, "Whether we realize it or not, each of us lives eternally in the red. We are everlasting debtors to known and unknown women and men. When we arise in the morning, we go into the bathroom and reach for a sponge which is provided for us by a Pacific Islander. We reach for soap that is created for us by a European. Then at the table we drink coffee provided for us by a South American, or tea by a Chinese, or cocoa by a West African. Before we leave the house, we're already beholden to more than half of the world." I think it is, actually this quality of gratitude is very important. I think it is truly helpful for us to be able to pause again and again in our day and to know this very life is a gift of many. You know, of course, we can go through our days preoccupied with all that we don't have, all that we've never received. And joy is certainly not a denial of the deep pain that can be felt in not having enough, not being enough, not enough love, not enough acceptance, not enough support in our life. Yet, if we come to a more present-centered focus, here we all are, actually in the only life we can live. And knowing in that we can choose, moment to moment, where we're going to make our home. Whether we're going to make our home in resentment or blame, or envy, or insufficiency, or whether we're going to make our home in our capacity for generosity and appreciation. There's also an aspect, I think, of this element of joy, which is about an inwardly offered appreciation. An appreciation, actually, of the qualities of effort and sincerity that we bring to this path. I mean, what we are doing here today, what many of you have done for many years, this kind of path you walk, this is not an easy thing. Now, there's a lot of other things you could be doing today, you know, the movies, the delights of retail therapy. There's a lot of other things you could be doing today. It's not easy for us to show up for ourselves. There's a lot of things, other things we could be doing with our mind today. Fantasizing, planning, you know, rehearsing, rather than making the efforts to actually be here in this life. I think it's always really so helpful to be aware that every moment in our life we are practicing something. There's never a moment that we're not practicing something. And we're either practicing and cultivating that which is helpful to ourselves and others. And in those moments when we're not, often what we find ourselves practicing are some of the old tired tendencies and habits of a lifetime. So here we are actually practicing, doing all that we can to actually plant the seeds of an inner freedom. It's not always easy, I think, in Westerners to develop this sense of appreciation for oneself. I encountered this much more often in Asia, strangely. You know, that you would meet someone, they tell you about how well they practiced today, you know, and you know how well they were doing, and you know, and they, it's wonderful few moments, you know, and the sense of actually it was okay to say that. You know, whereas in the West we seem to have this psychology that's geared towards a kind of self-belittlement, you know, a kind of false modesty, you know. Oh, I sort of thought I had a breath today, you know. Yeah, that minor moment of mindfulness here or there. But this kind of self-belittling tendency, where there's almost an inclination to focus on primarily what's wrong. Primarily what's wrong with us. I mean, probably there's a good deal in most of us that could do with a little improvement. But this tendency to focus primarily on what's wrong, we have to really ask what that does to the overall sense of our motivation, our inspiration, how much we feel encouraged inwardly. I mean, I'm sure we all see the kind of whispers of craving, the whispers of aversion, run through our day, that contract us, that close our hearts. But do we actually notice the moments of generosity, the moments of kindness, the moments of care, the moments that we might really extend ourselves for the benefit of ourselves or another? And this is what joy rests upon, this capacity to appreciate, to be able to receive, to be able to give. I have a friend who, a student who, a few years ago, he suffered on retreat a pretty major kidney failure, actually. And, you know, since then he's, you know, been basically struggling to stay alive. And I ran into him a few weeks ago at the gym, and he was running like a maniac. And I asked him if he was training for something. And he said, my brother has offered me one of his kidneys. He said, I'm going to have a transplant next week. And I saw the happiness in him, and I felt to myself this just tremendous sense of joy for him. And then he said to me, you know, just about the remarkable generosity of his brother. And then he said to me, and you know, my brother's not even on a spiritual path. well, I such crises, we may not need to be the recipient of such gifts, yet on a very daily basis, the well-being of our lives rests upon the kindness and the generosity of others. And so I think so much of this aspect of joy, of appreciation, of generosity is really an encouragement to move out of the language of I and you and into the language of us, into the language of we. And the teaching also speaks about this quality, as I've mentioned, of altruistic joy, our capacity to celebrate the happiness and well-being of another. It's meant to be an antidote to this sense of withholding, or this sense of envy or jealousy. Now, this is not about being happy because someone wins the lottery or, you know, gets a new car or something. That would be to trivialize, I think, this quality of joy. This altruistic joy, it's a quality of selflessness. It's really what arises when resentment or covetousness are not appearing. There's a few phrases from a Sri Lankan text which speak about this quality of joy, which is called mudita. Listen to them. Just listen to what your response to these phrases are. How wonderful you are in your being. I delight that you are here. I take joy in your good fortune. May your happiness continue. I must confess, and I have to confess, when I first heard these phrases, I had a cringe moment. Sentimental, you know, or, you know, sounds like something you might feel towards kind of a, you know, a newborn baby or, you know, a cute kitten or something, you know. And then I really reflected upon it, and I thought about these sentences and about that capacity just to delight in the well-being of another, or even just to delight in the aliveness of another. Now, it speaks a lot about selflessness. Now, when we look in our own experience, it's very interesting for me to look at the volume of selfing. Because, you know, when we think about self as a process, as a verb, and when we look about that process of selfing and the kind of volume of selfing in our day, do you notice that when you are really established in kindness, in generosity, in compassion, in friendliness, in empathy, do you notice how the voice of selfing becomes actually really quite quiet? Do you also notice that when we find ourselves in the day more established or more rooted in reactions such as fear or anxiety or aversion or envy, do you notice how the volume of selfing gets really big? How the sense of I and you gets really magnified? And that in the presence of the more, what we might call the more wholesome qualities, how that sense of I and you really reduces. When this quality of mudita, I think, is about being able to see the wholeness and the completeness of another rather than seizing upon the particulars, or rather than seizing upon a fragment. Notice when someone does something that annoys you. It can be something so minor, really. It sometimes doesn't take much to annoy us. I always think of the metaphor on retreats about you know, the person in front of us who takes the last piece of cheese, you know, or the person in front of us who happens to, you know, take the last slice of the bread that we wanted for tea. And that how forever after in our mind, they are the person who took the last piece of cheese. You know, this is all that we see. We have seized upon a particular. We seized upon a fragment of a person and see it becomes their whole. And it solidifies the other. Now, sometimes the other that is solidified, we actually see that same tendency self-directed. But sometimes the other that is solidified is actually an aspect of our own being. We might have a little voice of judgment. Many other voices in a day. But a little voice of judgment. Oh, I'm such a judgmental person. I've always been a judgmental person. You know, we might do something so innocuous as spill tea on the floor. Oh, I'm such a mindless person. Everybody knows I'm a mindless person. And you see the narrative get built up, and we see the tendency to seize upon a fragment and mistake it for to be the whole. Altruistic joy, the celebration of the wellness of another, the good fortune of another, the very aliveness of another, is really an encouragement to look at the places where we seize upon a fragment and mistake it to be the whole. Whether that is directed outwardly or directed inwardly. Because every time we do that, in a way, we actually suffocate our capacity for this aspect of joy. Another aspect of joy that is spoken about is actually the joy of mindfulness, the joy of wakefulness, the joy of feeling fully, wholeheartedly present in our life. It's also the joy of learning to actually celebrate the fruits of our practice. Learn to celebrate the fruits of our practice. This is also okay. This is not conceit. You know, it's not pride. It is where inspiration actually lies. There's an almost eternal law, I think, that as we learn to be more mindful in our life, as we learn to be more awake in our life, as we learn to be more present, so too does gladness and happiness and stillness deepen, teaching us what it means to be at peace with all things. That as our practice deepens, we begin to see for ourselves, moment to moment, where suffering is created, where it is born, how it is created, and how it falls away. And I have no doubt, actually, you know, in all the years of practice and teaching I've been engaged in, people again and again say, you know, I'm actually less impatient than I used to be. I'm less judgmental. I'm less aversive. I find myself greater capacity for kindness, greater capacity for compassion. And actually, these are the fruits of our practice. It's not a linear process. It's not that predictable. But there is a deepening, a kind of maturing of the heart that is born of our willingness to be present, to investigate, to understand. And there is actually a great joy in acknowledging that. There's a great joy in acknowledging the tastes of freedom that come into our lives, born of our own dedication, born of our own commitment, in acknowledging and celebrating those tastes of freedom. Now, I suspect that we have all tasted moments of joy in our life. Sometimes they're very, very fleeting. Sometimes they're more lasting. If we are to cultivate joy as an inclination of our heart, just as we cultivate metta or compassion or calmness as inclinations of our heart, then I think we come to the more challenging questions in our lives of what is it that actually stifles joy? What is it that leeches joy and happiness from our lives? One aspect is, as I've already mentioned today, sometimes we're just too full. Sometimes our minds, our lives are just too full to be catched by the quiet whispers of joy, that they can be drowned out by the volume of preoccupation, of habit, of busyness. It's so interesting for me in Chinese calligraphy that the symbol for busyness translates as heart killing. I find that very powerful. The symbol for busyness translating as heart killing. It's as if, you know, if we have one of these bells, if we stuff this bell full of cotton or full of padding and you try and ring it, you get no sound. The echoes can't be there. I recently read yet another research study that it was a work done by someone who worked a lot in hospice. And she'd written a book, some of you may have encountered it, upon the most frequently related deathbed regrets. And they're remarkably universal. Not laughing, not making space to laugh enough. Not making space to love enough. Not making space to actually be still enough, to care enough for those around oneself. It was remarkable to me that the kind of universality of these reflections. Thomas Merton, he once put it, he said, to allow oneself to be carried away by a multitude of conflicting concerns, to surrender to too many demands, to commit oneself to too many projects, to want to help everyone and everything, is to succumb to the violence of our times. This is a great challenge for us, I think, particularly in a lay life where the possibilities of doing are pretty endless, where there are so many voices calling upon us to do more, actually, even when our hearts are telling us to stop a little bit more and to pause a little bit more. There's so much pressure in our world to become someone, to become something, to accomplish, to perform as measures of our worthiness. And we need to be so mindful of the effect of those voices and those pulls. They're not always external, they're often internal. We need to be so mindful of the effect of those voices upon the quality of our own hearts and minds, and whether they are really leading us, inclining us in a direction of heart where we want to be. So much of our capacity for joy, I feel, is directly related to our capacity for inner stillness. To be able to listen, to see. Of course, we all have responsibilities in this life. We're asked to show up for them. And I think this inclination towards more stillness is not an encouragement towards the abdication of those responsibilities, but to look at where that edge is for us, where we're actually not responding anymore, and where we're more just coping or surviving. And I think this practice is something about something much deeper than coping or surviving. I think it's about thriving. And thriving really relies upon us taking care of the quality of our own hearts and minds. And in truth, no one can actually do that for us. What we really see is that the shape of our life mostly reflects the shape of our mind. If our minds are agitated, our lives are likely to be agitated. You know, if our minds are filled with preoccupation, our lives will mostly take on those shades. We see that the shape of our mind gives birth to the shape of our life. And when our minds are filled with preoccupations, obsessions, planning, projects, we hear the hum of that going through our thoughts, the unfinished symphony that's actually never going to be finished. We can worry and think about so many things. And what this practice teaches us is that habit of worrying, preoccupation, agitation, that it's not at all a life sentence. That this is the fullness, the inner fullness, that we learn to empty a little bit. That we learn to calm. That we learn that we can bring greater stillness, greater quietude into our minds and into our lives. It's not an easy practice, but it is a practice of the moment, of learning to listen to the story of our bodies, the story of our minds. Ajahn Chah once said, he said, if you let go a little, you'll have a little peace. If you let go a lot, you'll have a lot of peace. And if you let go completely, you will have complete peace. And much of our coming to silence inwardly, stillness inwardly, not deadness, is about learning to let go. I think the wondrous thing about joy is that we really don't have to wait for sadness or sorrow or fear to go away. We don't have to wait for our thoughts to stop. It is a relational quality. In the midst of sadness, in the midst of responsibility, what does it mean for us to learn that art of cultivating these small pauses, these small ways of learning how to stop, to step out of our own story? Sometimes those ways are really practical. When we see ourselves about to launch into some sort of, you know, whirlwind of doing, maybe actually that's the right moment to stop, to step outside, to look at the sky, to be able to listen to our body. When we see ourselves about to launch into a kind of agitated flurry of busyness, when everything within us, you know, has that compelling tone, you know, I need to, that sense of urgency. In my life, I have long learned to listen to be or to be very suspicious of urgency. You know, when that thought arises, I really need to do this, or I really need to say this, or I really need to get this going. That sense of urgency to me is like a little bit of an alarm bell. Maybe not. Maybe that's not what this moment most needs. When we learn to actually open the field, the sphere of our listening, so that we're not just listening to the agitation of our own minds, we're listening to the song of the bird, we're listening to the sounds of the cars coming and going, what we start to know is really change. It's really process. That just as that sound arises and passes, so too with this sadness, so too with this sorrow, so too with this project, that all things arise and pass, and perhaps the greater importance is for where we are making our home. When we look carefully, I think, at our own minds and hearts, we actually see that it's not life that stifles joy. I've identified two primary tendencies that have a remarkable capacity to suffocate joy. One is obsession, and the other is craving. You might just think about those in your own experience. What the effect of those two are, obsession and craving, what they do to your mind, what they do to your heart. Do joy and obsession simultaneously exist? Does joy and craving, do they coexist? What we see with obsession is that there's a kind of turning inwardly, becoming a prisoner of emotionally driven thought processes. And we see that obsession, the very nature of it, isn't it? It's to contract. Our world becomes smaller and smaller. Our world becomes tighter and tighter. Until this kind of agitated thinking kind of rules consciousness and it rules our life. So obsession has this tendency to turn in and to contract. We see that craving, the very force of craving, which can actually permeate a lot of our lives, has a different effect, because the effect of craving is to turn outwardly and to look for a substitute for joy. And that's where we become agitated with all the things we need to get, the things we need to become, the things we need to attain, all that we don't have, the kind of agitation around that, the kind of person we feel that we need to be. I see that the work of metta, kindness, is to uproot aversion. The work of compassion is allow us to meet sorrow and pain without fear. I really see that the work of joy is actually to uproot the tendencies of aversion, of obsession and craving. And that it really involves actually really being aware of those patterns as they move through our lives. Being aware if they actually do suffocate joy. Being aware that we may be able to step out of those patterns. That we may actually have the motivation, the willingness to turn inwardly and begin to question for ourselves whether it is possible for us to discover and to touch an inwardly generated joy, an inwardly generated sense of sufficiency, an inwardly generated, in that sense, an inwardly generated quality of freedom. Rumi, he once put it, he said, today, like any other day, we wake up empty and frightened. Don't open the door to the study and begin reading. Take down a musical instrument. Let the beauty we love be what we do. That there are hundreds of ways to kneel and kiss the ground. An encouragement to not always answer discontent with doing. That courage to really respond to discontent or feelings of inner insufficiency by turning inwardly. See whether it is possible, like countless people in this path have done over centuries, to really taste that inner freedom, that inwardly generated capacity for joy. I wanted to end with a poem. So some of you may be familiar with by Naomi Shihab Nye. She says, it's difficult to know what to do with so much happiness, with sadness as something to rub against, a wound to tend with lotion and cloth. When the world falls in around you, you have pieces to pick up, something to hold in your hands, like ticket stubs or change. But happiness floats. It doesn't need you to hold it down. It doesn't need anything. Happiness lands on the roof of the next house, singing, and disappears when it wants to. You are happy either way. Even the fact that you once lived in a peaceful treehouse and now live over a quarry of noise and dust cannot make you unhappy. Everything has a life of its own. It too could wake up filled with possibilities of coffee cake and ripe peaches, and love even the floor which needs to be swept, the soiled linens and scratched records. Since there's no place large enough to contain so much happiness, you shrug, you raise your hands, and it flows out of you into everything you touch. You're not responsible. You take no credit, as the night sky takes no credit for the moon, but continues to hold it and share it, and in that way be known. Thank you.